Good afternoon. Welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. I'm busy dropping the ball. Forgot to call our guest. Oops.
Oh, what the heck?
As the music starts, I'm like, oh, whoops, we forgot.
We talked about this, remember?
We've had 2 weeks. Sorry, we had guest failure the last couple of weeks. Just people were busy, stuff going on, so we had to abdicate. Anyway, today would be November 28th, believe it or not, 2021. We've almost put another idiotic year in the... We thought last year was the idiotic year.
Yeah, this year.
Now we're almost done with the second idiotic year.
This year was the rerun.
Rerun of last year's idiotic year. Before we do our sponsor and all that, I just want you to write down the new name of the new fake virus that we have or whatever it is.
The one that gives you a stuffy nose?
The one that gives
I'm
you...
I'm terrified.
No, I think it makes
myself.
You cough. It gives you sniffles and a cough or something.
Oh, and a cough.
And it's O-M-I-C-R-O-N, right? Letter in the Greek alphabet. But if you're into anagrams, you might not... Well, if you're into anagrams, you already figured it out. But if you're not into anagrams, you just rearrange those letters. And oddly enough, it spells moronic. So we have now entered the new moronic variant. And you heard it here first.
But the good news is they're going to have a vaccine for that in 2 weeks.
Is it called Smartness?
Yeah.
We're going to have a Smartness vaccine.
Yay! They're going to want everybody to get it. It's been under, they've been researching it now for 3 weeks, and they'll have it ready.
Because they had a vision.
Yeah. And that's what
they'll stop your stuffy nose. Where's that been my whole life?
I know it.
For heaven's sake, I can stop taking allergy pills. So anyway, my name is Erin Ryan.
I don't think anybody figured that out yet. My name is Bill Cundiff, and our sponsor this hour is Pat Bay Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. Pat Bay Machinery is everything John Deere green. You need a tractor, a mower, attachments. Go up and see them. They've got it all in stock. Got a pretty good inventory right now. They've also got a fully staffed shop and parts department. So if you need parts or service, go up and talk to them. They're located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in Shasta Lake City. Or you can give them a call at 226-9226. They'll be there all week. This was kind of a short week, this Thanksgiving week, but next week will be a full week for them, so get up there and get your John Deere stuff all lined out for Christmas. They're also a Steel Power Products and a Honda dealer, so they've got some generators in stock. They've got some steel products up there if you want to put some of that under the tree. Or give them or stop by the website. At
theoldwebsite.com.
Yeah, theoldwebsite.com, papaymachinery.com.
There you go. And so while we're doing everything backwards, we're like contraries. Wash with dirt. Does that go?
while Nero fiddles.
Nothing's burning, though.
Like, yeah, that's
kinda,
true.
Kinda
not yet.
You're about a month behind. Hey, I just wanted to let people know you can always find everything on our website at wethepeopleradio.us. So you have links to a lot of things, books and all sorts of stuff. And you also have show archives that are on there with no commercials. Not that we don't love the advertisers, but there are no commercials in there. So that'll save you a little bit of time. They're an MP3 file, so you can, you know, download them or share them or do whatever you want.
Yeah.
Also on the front page, you will see that there is a new website, not the We the People website, but there's another one. It's called My Place on the Wall, and the web address for that is myplaceonthewall.com. Because if we're going to defend the Republic, everyone's going to have to take their place on the wall, so you better figure out what yours is. And some of what needs to be done is people need to pipe up a little bit more. I know there's a big push to silence everyone, but they can only silence you if you stop talking. That is a website where you can post video, you can post articles, you can start a blog, you can connect with other people. It's sort of in the format of Facebook, has nothing to do with Facebook. The only administrator on the site would be yours truly. Listed there as John Galt because I just, you know, I'm an Atlas Shrugged fan. If you've never read it, you should get with that. if they're going to lock you in your house, make sure you have a copy of Atlas Shrugged. It'll keep you busy for a while. Anyway, it's a place where people can share quite a bit. I know they're putting up a lot of information about the vaccine and things like that that are getting taken down off Facebook. So there is zero moderation on that website. And if you read something you don't like, please comment to the person who posted it, because it will not be taken down. Unless, of course, you know, it's, you know, mean pictures about puppies or something like that. So.
Oh, so you do have limits.
Yeah. Yeah. If you're going to. Yeah. If you're going to abuse puppies or, you know, do something else ridiculous, we'll have to take that down. But for your opinion, you can have your opinion there. Isn't that nice? Imagine that. Oh. So my phone is back in the room. Travis scurried it back in, which means he called Dr. Pry, who is patiently waiting. And sorry about that. I forgot to give him the number when we got here. Oh, these things. You know, you make these great plans. I actually called him and double-checked, made sure we were on for today, and then, you know, fumbled the ball. That's what happens when I have too much time on my hands. Our guest today, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, has been with us before, and I have listed shows that he has done with us before because they are chock full of information. There's also quite a bit of information on the site about the things we're going to discuss, but he's the executive director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security and the director of the U.S. Nuclear Strategy Forum. Both of those are congressional advisory boards. He also serves on the Congressional EMP Commission, the Congressional Strategic Posture Commission, and the House Armed Services Committee. Dr. Pry was an intelligence officer with the CIA, and he was responsible for analyzing Soviet and Russian nuclear strategy. He has a PhD in history and archaeology and another one in strategic studies, which led him to the CIA. He's the author of numerous books, The War to Save America, Apocalypse Unknown, and I have those kind of on the bottom of the page for today. Blackout Warfare, The Power and the Light, Blackout Wars, The Manhattan Project. So there's some great stuff, and he is a terrific researcher and a super smart guy, and we love having him on. We always learn a lot. So I have posted Dr. Pry. I posted for today's deal Operation Dragon, Inside the Kremlin's Secret War on America, and then the second book by Molly Hemingway called Rigged. So...
Okay.
We're set.
Well, I'm gonna break my word to you and start off by talking about another book.
Nice.
Because I just finished watching The Last of the Mohicans.
Oh yeah,
great movie.
Thanksgiving weekend, James Fenimore Cooper's classic work. Great movie. Though I would recommend everybody to read the actual book. And if you ever get a chance to visit Cooperstown, New York, it brought back memories of when I was elementary school in Cooperstown is in, I lived in upstate New York, or really geographically, it's the central New York. You know, everything in New York is described relative to its location to New York City, which is, they refer to upstate New York when, in fact, geographically, the town of Marcy and Utica is right smack dab in the center of New York. It's central New York State. And Cooperstown was, less than a day's drive. You know, it was a little south of us in an area called the Southern Tier, which is still, not well developed. It's just, small towns and hamlets. Cooperstown is, I don't even think it qualifies as a city. Most people know of it because of the baseball museum, which is in Cooperstown. What most people talk about it, but it has the home of James Fenimore Cooper, you can still visit his home and see various things that he collected, there when he was writing in the early 19th century. And his novels, he wrote more than The Last of the Mohicans. He wrote a whole bunch of books. They're all fiction, but loosely based on what life was like on what was then the American frontier, which was central New York State. You know, people find it hard to imagine of New York as being the frontier, but it was back in those days. And as you can see from the movie The Last of the Mohicans, for example, it talks about the French and Indian War, being fought basically in central New York State, around Lake George is where most of the action happens. There's a massacre in the film that that actually happened. In fact, the broad contours of the description are true. You know, they just have some fictional characters and a love story set against the backdrop. And that's true of a lot of Cooper's writings. I remember another one of his books, much less well known, is called The Wept of Wishtown Wish, which describes what it was like to be living in New England on the New England frontier, probably a century before the French and Indian War, in the late 1600s, and to be fighting off Indians. You know, most of the his novels involve good Indians, bad Indians, but, you know, the expansion of America, the settling of what was then the West, you know, which was, you know, like Central New York State. And, you know, the, so that's a, so if you ever get a chance to go to Cooperstown, New York, highly recommend it. You get to, they probably still have real rock candy, which was a candy that was around in the 1700s and 1800s. You know, it's basically crystallized sugar on a string, but very good, excellent. And you can get to see some oddities there, too. I believe when I was a kid, the Cardiff Giant was still on display, and they probably still have him at Cooperstown, New York. The Cardiff Giant was an enormous hoax. A farmer, you know, Darwinism had just broken onto the scene about, you know, how human beings had evolved from lower life forms. And a farmer in New York claimed to have come across a petrified man from an earlier time, and he had made a big concrete giant out in his field and was charging people money to see this wonder. And it got packed up, and it's probably still on display in Cooperstown, New York. The gullibility level of people. Well, I'm not going to condemn their gullibility in the 19th century. After all, people believe in more absurd things today.
I was just going to say.
But, you know, people are always perpetually gullible. There were people that were, well, call them scientific cults, for example, that were very popular. People who believed in the hollow earth theory, for example. You know, the idea that the world was really hollow and you could get inside it, if you could get to one of the poles, that you could probably get inside the hollow earth and that there would be, it would be, that was their version of going to the moon and discovering moon men. And,
well, now they think the earth is flat, so, again.
Right. So. You know, and the, and a lot of, what's the polite word for them? Utopian movements. Occurred as New York State got settled, and in the 19th century, it was like San Francisco and the Silicon Valley is today. You know, it, eventually, as the frontier got settled and they introduced canals and the railroad, you know, these were cutting-edge, high-tech things. Also, new ways of making money on Wall Street. You know, by stocks. Instead of actually working for money, okay, people could shuffle paper and manipulate paper and make fortunes off of this paper, which most Americans didn't trust for good reason and still don't trust today. But there was a time, and they believed in a lot of cutting-edge causes, some of them good, some of them bad. For example, I think in 1849, there was the first meeting of the early feminists for women's rights at Niagara Falls, New York. The abolitionist movement was extremely strong, and they had Underground Railroad, you know, people working in upstate New York against the slave movement. So, you know, a lot of the what was then considered far left, almost crazy ideas, and things that were crazy, like as it happened, not far from where I lived, there was a utopian colony called in Oneida, and where they basically tried to they rejected the idea of the nuclear family. And they, of course, this was dreamed up by a male minister, all right? and he rejected the idea of the nuclear family. A man could, they believed in free love. You know, you could live together in a commune and people could have sex with each other without being married. The children would be held in common, so they wouldn't have just two parents, but they'd be raised by everybody. And
like it isn't hard enough with two parents.
Right, exactly. Anyway, it only lasted one generation, as most of these utopian things do, and until it imploded. But one of the things that came out of it, because the way they supported themselves, was by making silverware. And to this day, you can buy a Knight of Silver. It's still an important company. One of the few things that's left in upstate New York that makes anything. And then, of course, the Mormons, you know, started in upstate New York. John Smith claimed to have discovered, tablets buried on Mount Cumorah and had an encounter with the angel Morani, who told him about, Christ coming to the New World and an ancient civilization that had existed at upstate New York and in North America, and again there was a sexually liberating aspect about it, at least for men, in that the idea was that you could live like the patriarchs of old Israel and have more than one wife. Somehow, almost all these millennialist movements in the 19th century had something to do with men being able to have sex with more than one partner or more than one woman, and it not being a bad thing, becoming part of a new religion. But
it was a new religion, all right.
Right, you know.
The kind your mother warned you about. We've got to take a really quick break. We'll be right back. Almost choked.
Yeah, don't do that.
I know. Did you hear that?
Yeah, I did.
It was Bill. Bill did it.
I was going to ask you with the paddle.
that's why I almost choked. Oh, my gosh. Well, we'll be right back. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Colder, summer getting warmer, tidal wave come across the Mexican border. Why buy a gallon? It's cheaper by the barrel. Just don't get busted singing Christmas carols. That's us. That's right. Gotta love this American ride. Both ends of the ozone burning. Funny how the world keeps turning. Look, Ma, no hands. I love this American.
And we're back.
There you go.
Back to Cooperstown.
Well, the last thing I'll just say about Cooperstown, and I may have mentioned it already, is the journey there itself, if you cast your mind back to New York as being the frontier, you know, that at one time it was. It's not hard to imagine that when you travel to Cooperstown because, I mean, unlike downstate New York, the environs of New York City, upstate New York, you know, the travel, it's so out of the way. It's still so remote. It's still so unsettled. I mean, there's just little hamlets and villages. I'll bet the population probably hasn't grown that much since the early 19th century. So it's not hard to imagine, you know, going back to Cooperstown, the time when this was the frontier, and for America, and if one can afford to go there, given the way gas prices are going and everything else, you know, it might be worth an escape from these stressful, traumatic times to take a visit to American history, because we're all so
before they take it all down
consumed with worry about the direction this country is taking. And I guess we'll move on to the next topic, you know, which is Operation Dragon. The book I want, one of the books I wanted to talk about today, which in a ways is one of the most disturbing books I think anyone will ever read, because it really raises questions in one mind. Maybe the title for your show today should have been "The Rigging of America." The Rigging of America. You know, later we'll talk about the rigged elections, and I'm sure all of your listeners know about the rigged elections and have, and one hardly needs to be convinced that the elections were rigged. But the problem with our country goes back way before 2020, and this is one of the books that'll really shake your confidence in the honesty of our institutions and whether the federal government has ever been straight with the American people. Operation Dragon is written by my friend and former boss at the CIA, Jim Woolsey, in cooperation with Ion Pasipa, who was the head of Romanian intelligence when Romania belonged to the Warsaw Pact. And this is the first book ever written by a former director of Central Intelligence, a former head of a Western intelligence agency, in cooperation jointly with a former head of a Warsaw Pact from the Soviet sphere intelligence agency. And there's a lot in the book, but I think the most striking thing about the book, and the reason I wanted to talk about it today, is because we're just coming out of the Thanksgiving holiday. You know, in a nutshell, the book really makes a compelling case. I think they virtually prove the case that, yes, Khrushchev and the USSR did assassinate John F. Kennedy. It wasn't the CIA. It wasn't the organized crime, but the Soviets did it. And I find it enormously frustrating because, you know, in my gut, and I think any thinking American has probably suspected that all along, but we've been told by our government, because of the Warren Commission, that Oswald acted alone, that there was no evidence that that the Soviets were involved, when in fact there's really overwhelming evidence that the Soviets were involved when you read the book and you get it unpacked, and even just by common sense, some of the things that didn't have to be revealed. You know, what a coincidence, you know, that Oswald was a committed communist, and that he had been in the Soviet Union for months before he came over to the United States to assassinate Kennedy. And what a coincidence that the assassination happened not too long after Khrushchev's humiliation after the Cuban Missile Crisis. You know, anybody who was just reading the newspaper headlines probably would have come to the conclusion that the Soviets must have done it. You know, but it took our own government intervening with the Warren Commission and all this, you know, BS to try to make the case that that no, Oswald acted on his own. It wasn't part of a larger Soviet conspiracy. And if they're going to lie to us about such a fundamental thing as that, if they have such trust, going back that long ago, okay, when America was a very different place, but still the government didn't trust the people enough and didn't trust the judgment of the people. Just how long has it been that that the ruling elites, you know, have been manipulating public opinion and manipulating the American people and lying to us and keeping the truth from us because they fundamentally don't trust us and see the American people as untutored troglodytes, you know, who can't be trusted with the truth. And I distinctly recall, even though I was only, how old was I, 1954, 63, so I was, 7 years old, but I still can remember. I remember this. I remember being really disappointed that when the assassination happened on the November 22nd, you know, it was heading up toward Thanksgiving. And usually, you know, I mean, this is a period of real celebration and family gatherings and everything. And it just ruined Thanksgiving. As the selfish little kid that I was, you know, I can remember being really disappointed that, you know, that the television, we only had three channels back in those days,
yep.
was full of nothing but the assassination, and that all Americans, including my parents, were just so downcast by what had happened that the celebration seemed to have been ruined. And then I remember actually seeing on TV, I remember distinctly, it was in the living room with my mother. I was playing some game on the floor, and she was ironing clothes. And I remember actually seeing on the TV Jack Ruby coming up and shooting Kennedy, or excuse me, shooting Oswald, so that Oswald was assassinated. And according to the book, that was, Ruby had connections to organized crime, and the organized criminals had connections back to Soviet intelligence services, and that too was part of the deal. And Woolsey and Pasipo make a really good case that the Soviets had arranged a massive disinformation campaign designed to come up with other theories, you know, so that they would not be blamed for the Kennedy assassination. And they named names and they named books, and a number of the books, you know, were written that came out. They were practically ready to go within a year after the assassination. That ended up blaming the CIA and the FBI or organized crime. And these books were written by people that Woolsey and Pasipa point out, we now know, had ties to the KGB and the Soviet intelligence services, and they were part of the useful idiot network of journalists and reporters and writers that were on the Soviet payroll or were agents of influence, you know, that the Soviets were able to use. And it was an incredibly successful disinformation campaign, and our government and our intelligence agencies have spent years, you know, going along with that cover-up. They point out in the book, we had a defector from Cuba, you know, about 15 years ago, who was working in the Cuban intelligence services in their his job. Cuba's equivalent of NSA. They were listening to television and radio broadcasts in the United States. And this guy remembers that he was given specific instructions, you know, to be monitoring the TV and radio broadcasts coming out of the Dallas, Texas region on the day before, the day during, and then the day after the assassination. Castro had arranged to have a on the day of the assassination to have a meeting with French journalists so that he could act all surprised and shocked in front of useful idiots from the West, useful reporters from the West, you know, as if he had no idea about what was happening, when in fact he was in on it. He was informed by the Soviets of the plan to kill Kennedy. So it's a book I highly recommend people read. There's more in it than the Kennedy assassination, but I think that is incredibly important. And the fact that the book has not gotten any publicity, most people don't even know of its existence, is just very disturbing to me. It shows the, you know, raises questions about how free are we really as a people, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know? How much information are we really allowed to get? The book can get published, but then its existence is basically, you know,
kind of kept secret.
Yeah, basically gets pushed off, and it should be making headlines in the New York Times and the Washington Post and all of the usual places. Why did our own government want to keep it secret? The theory in the book is that, and this is entirely plausible, you know, is that, you know, the Johnson administration didn't want to get in a war with the Soviet Union, a nuclear war with the Soviet Union. And they thought that the American people couldn't be trusted with the truth, you know, that there would be a public outcry for revenge. And they're probably right about that, but that doesn't mean the public outcry would be such that the government would have to be forced to push the button. You know, it's ultimately up to them. They didn't want to be put in the politically embarrassing situation of having to explain, look, you know, there's other ways that we will try to get our revenge. And history kind of took its revenge because Khrushchev didn't, his career didn't survive the assassination attempt. And this wasn't the only assassination. When you read the book, you know, Khrushchev was very big on assassinating political opponents in the West and had done it more than once before the hit on Kennedy. And one of the reasons he did it was because he knew that his career was going to soon be over because the Politburo was so unhappy with the outcome of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Khrushchev had led them into that. He was confident that he was going to be able to prevail and that they were going to be able to keep missiles in Cuba and that Kennedy didn't have the guts to get into a nuclear conflict over that, but he'd miscalculated because of the advantage that we had built up in intercontinental nuclear missiles. They had a big advantage when it came to theater nuclear missiles opposite NATO Europe. That's where Moscow thought World War III was going to be fought, in NATO Europe. He didn't think that it would get to such a crisis that would bring us to the brink of an intercontinental nuclear war. And there they were weak. They hadn't built up their forces to match ours, at that time. And so Khrushchev basically was taken out. Some people even think that his early demise was a punishment from the Politburo, you know, to eliminate him, for his failures. So that's the first thing I wanted to draw to your listeners' attention. You've got it in the title of your show today, Operation Dragon, by Jim Woolsey and Ian Pasipa. You know, definitely short. Not a long book, but definitely worth a read. It really raises these questions in one's mind and is great food for thought about, wow, just how long has the government been lying to us? Oh, the other thing about Johnson is, of course, Johnson did not like Kennedy or the Kennedy brothers, and he had started off and they didn't like him. The Kennedy New England establishment, the Northeast liberal establishment, did not like Johnson. He was an old-time Southern politician, a deeply corrupt politician, an anti-intellectual. He used to humiliate. This part isn't in the book, but I know this from other writings, that Johnson liked to, after he became president, he liked to humiliate the Harvard, Yale, Kennedy School-type advisors forcing them to talk to him while he went to the toilet in the bathroom. And he was that kind of a guy. He was hoping that he would be reelected and that he would become a great figure in history himself. And so he wanted to move away from the Camelot myth that the press was so fixated on, so that the folks focus would be on him, which is another reason he wanted to try to wrap up and sweep under the cover, the carpet, as it were, the Kennedy assassination, so that would not become the whole focus of his administration, and then another international crisis that he would have to deal with, and maybe not successfully. So
history has not
I will pause
not been kind
okay,
to him.
Sorry.
I was going to say, and history hasn't really been kind to him, because stories like that about all his crudeness and stuff are really pretty, those are pretty well publicized. I don't think I don't think anybody buried those stories. That seems to be the thing you think of when you, his name comes up. We've got to take a really quick break. We'll be.
And how many of them are also, how true are some of them? You know, one has to wonder.
Well, that's true too.
We know they suppress lies to us about their political enemies, and the Northeast liberal establishment was never kind to Johnson. They hated him. And so, you know, maybe some of that stuff isn't true.
Wow. You know, it's like we're just on shifting sand. You know, write everything in pencil. We're going to have to bring pencils back. We're going to need the erasers, I think. We've got to take a quick break. Our guest today is Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. You are listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
In the town where I was raised, the clock ticks and the cattle graze. Time passed with amazing grace back where I come from. You can lie on a riverbank, paint your name on a water tank, discount all the beers you drank back where I come from.
Sometimes I want to light up underneath the no-smoking sign. Sometimes I wish they'd tell me how justice got so blind. I wish they'd just leave me alone, 'cause I'm doing all right. You can take your change on down the road and leave me here with mine. 'Cause that ain't my America, that ain't this country.
Figured Lyndon Johnson would have liked Lynyrd Skynyrd.
Yeah.
They would have been kindred spirits, perhaps.
Dr. Pry, you know, speaking of Russia and the relationship we had back then, how would you compare that to where we are today? I mean, it seems a little precarious, our current relationship with Russia. Is not in a good place right now. Do you think it's worse now than it was then?
Yes, I think it's worse now than it was then because the strategic balance has shifted so much against us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the hatred is still there. There's still an authoritarian/totalitarian system that hates our free system and sees our freedom is an existential threat to them. They see our leadership of the free world as an existential threat to them. And it's they still see the world as a zero-sum game. They don't believe in coexistence. They think there's going to be a winner and a loser, one side living, the other side dead. They want to be the winners. And they have the means to win now. They might have had the means to win, but the military and nuclear balance was much more favorable to us back in the Kennedy days, back in the Cold War days, right through the days of Ronald Reagan, even though in the aftermath of the Cuban Missile Crisis, they went gangbusters to catch up and then surpass us in intercontinental ballistic missiles, you know, because they realized that the intercontinental balance of power was the ultimate level of destruction, was the most important part of the geopolitical chessboard. Fortunately, throughout the Cold War, we went from, it's not fortunate that we went from superiority to parity, but at least we didn't allow them to achieve the tremendous advantages that they have over us today. And so because they have the means to win, that's you know, that makes us more imperiled. The advantages that that Russia and China together have over us are such that they might be able to win without war. And that's what they're shooting for. And I don't think most Americans are aware about just how close we are to losing the new Cold War without war. It could take a policy change. We're on the verge of making it now, actually. And I don't think most people understand how catastrophic it would be. It could virtually overnight change the global order from one led by the United States to one dominated by them. And I make that distinction because the United States does not dominate the global order. We're a free society and we believe in freedom for our allies. We lead the free world. We don't dominate it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they will dominate it. And a new global order based on domination by totalitarian systems is not going to be good for us in the short run or the long run. It's going to be catastrophic for us in many ways, you know, not just in terms of the military peril to us, but in terms of the economics and lifestyle and our ability to get the kinds of things we need to survive. In effect, I think we'll find ourselves besieged, you know, the way England was besieged, in not by an active submarine network, you know, sinking our vessels, but by decisions made by China, for example, to cut us off from critical goods that you need to compete technologically, to make goods, to remain an advanced technological society. But I'm getting ahead of myself, and what is the thing that could happen that could lose the new Cold War for us, that could lose, call it World War III without firing a shot? And it is this thing, maybe many of your listeners haven't heard of it. Well, regular listeners to your show probably have, because we must have talked about the nuclear no first use pledge on your show before.
Yes.
I'm pretty sure we have. And this is one of the things under consideration in the nuclear posture review. There have not been many nuclear posture reviews, or the NPR, are really important to the way the United States runs its nuclear deterrent. They're really important. There have not been many of them. I think there have been 5 or 6 in the whole history of our nuclear deterrent, 5 or 6 nuclear posture reviews where we have sat down and really thought seriously about what are we going to do now, you know, in terms of managing our nuclear deterrent. And the nuclear posture review provides the guidelines for how many nuclear weapons are we going to have. What are the role of nuclear weapons in U.S. national security policy? What is the mix of ICBMs and bombers and submarines and tactical nuclear weapons? And thinks is supposed to think through all that. And what are the policies by which we use or don't use nuclear weapons? And one of the things that has been really critical is the fact that the United States has never signed on to what's called the nuclear no first use pledge. We have never promised our adversaries, that we will not use nuclear weapons first. We've always maintained ambiguity about whether or not we will use nuclear weapons first. The fact that we don't have a nuclear no first use pledge implies that, yeah, we are willing to use nuclear weapons first. And we were during the Cold War. It's what kept the Cold War from becoming a hot war, because the Soviet Union had an overwhelming advantage in conventional weapons right after World War II, all through the Cold War. They had like a 5-to-1 advantage in tanks and a 10-to-1 advantage in artillery, a 3-to-1 advantage in fighter aircraft against us and our NATO allies all combined. But compensating for that was that we had 15,000 tactical nuclear weapons, you know, and we were willing to use them first, you know, and if it escalated to strategic exchange where the homelands were involved, you know, we wouldn't just be using tactical nuclear weapons on battlefields of European NATO, but it would go into a homeland-homeland exchange. And that big gamble, maybe it was a big bluff, but it but the Soviets believed it, and they believed it because we had the forces. You know, we were building the capability, and we had the plans, and we exercised those plans, and it was credible enough that they never threw the cosmic dice and risked the World War III. And so we accomplished something that has almost never been, yeah, I think never been accomplished in history, not just almost, but never been accomplished, where you had two great superpowers head-to-head like that, and one of them disintegrates and loses everything, including its own existence, peacefully, without there being a war. In the past, one side would always try to prevail. I mean, if they saw their strength ebbing, they would roll those cosmic dice. You ended up having a world war or a major war of some kind, and this is true going all the way back, you know, to the Persians and the Greeks, you know, that instead of passively accepting defeat. And that's especially impressive when you consider we were dealing with the Soviet Union, you know, an inhumane, totalitarian monstrosity that was just as bad as Nazi Germany, just as aggressive. But fortunately, their elites feared enough for their own lives that they didn't chance it. And, you know, we were credibly able to threaten their existence enough. And this, the idea, though, you know, the left has been pushing for us to follow China's good example. For example, China still has, and the Soviet Union at one time had the fiction of a no-first-use pledge. They've put that out there, hoping that we would follow their good example and also give a no-first-use pledge, because these totalitarian systems who lie all the time know that their no-first-use pledge would be a lie, and they would not honor it. But we, as a free, law-abiding, we believe in international law, we believe when we give political commitments verbally and or in writing, that we honor them. And so it would be a unilateral constraint on our actions, but no constraint at all on theirs. They knew that, and that's why they put that out. And we knew after the fall of the Soviet Union, when we captured Warsaw Pact nuclear planning documents, that it was a lie. You know, they had, not only did they plan to strike first, they planned to strike first almost from the very beginning of war, massively.
Imagine that, a lie.
Get a nuclear Pearl Harbor.
Hold that thought, Dr. Pryor. We're coming up on the news break here pretty quick. You are listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
That dancing girl is making eyes at me. I'm sure she's working for the KGB in this paradise. Ah, cold as ice. Moonlight and vodka takes me.